Hi, welcome back to the show. Well, in the second hour of today's show, I've got a new guest on who's here to talk about his work in Israel and the Gaza Strip in terms of bringing awareness to the world about the situation there. Very important topic, one which we haven't covered on Truth News for quite a while, not because it's not important, it's just that there are so many things that we try to do on the show, and I only have a chance to do a show once a week. And it has been a while since we've had anyone on the show who's been in Israel. So it's actually going to be quite interesting to get the latest information on what's happening there with the Palestinian situation and Gaza. So I'd like to welcome now to the show Harry Fear, independent filmmaker and activist to Truth News. Harry, are you there?
I am. Thank you very much for having me on.
It's a great pleasure. Great pleasure, Harry. And you've got a very impressive record in terms of what you've done already, and you're still pretty young. So I imagine you've got quite an interesting life ahead of you.
Well, I certainly hope so. We'll see what happens. In fact, I mean, Gaza has been my focus since, I suppose for 2 years now, really. But I first went to the Gaza Strip last summer,
right,
and made a bunch of films there and reported during the war there in November. So I have managed to do quite a bit of work, but I guess it's not enough to satisfy my appetite. There's so much more I want to do. But yeah, thank you.
Indeed. And so you've spent time in Gaza. Is that your main focus at the moment? I know you're doing a few different projects, and you've actually got a plan to bring a convoy of interested people and activists and journalists to Gaza this year.
Yes, it is the focus because, in a sense, I don't like to spread myself too thinly. I mean, after some time, I do hope to move on and cover other areas. But for me, this isn't just something of intellectual interest. This is something I'm deeply passionate about. So it's something which I can't prize my heart away from. And also, having obviously had experience covering Gaza and making films in Gaza, not continuing that for a while in a way is not efficient, so there are so many more films I want to make to capture the reality of Gaza, because it's a place which is very special to me, and the suffering there is really incredible, and the world needs to hear about it. And so for me, my motivation is to try and do my bit to make the world hear and see the suffering that goes on in Gaza.
Indeed. And, it's really sorely needed, because there has been a bit of a dearth of information coming out of that area. I've talked about that on this show quite a bit with the crisis that happened around about 10 years ago when the activist Rachel Corrie was killed and I believe another filmmaker there was shot dead. I think that had a dampening effect, would you say, on people going there and reporting on what's going on?
Oh, definitely. And also the case of the Italian activist Vittorio Arrigoni. You mentioned Rachel Corrie. There was also Tom Hurdle, I think his name was.
Yes.
And these three cases really did cause a problem in terms of that dampening effect, that downward pressure on international visits to the Gaza Strip. And these international visits are very important, because not only do they affect the numbers of activists going, they affect the numbers of journalists going, they affect the possibilities for international projects of cooperation, economic development, partnerships, and all sorts of things, as well as the general security situation being bad. That also affects, diplomatic visits, politicians going as well. So
yes,
it did have a very bad effect. But the good news is that since really last spring, I guess, the Egyptian border with the Gaza Strip, because Gaza borders obviously Israel, Mediterranean Sea, and Egypt, the Egyptian border crossing in a way kind of opened in a new way under Morsi.
Okay.
Who's obviously now gone.
Yeah.
But under Morsi, the border opened, and this really allowed a kind of flourishing of visits again from internationals. So that did see a marked improvement. Obviously, what's happened since Morsi has gone is that's dipped to really a very bad low, which is the reason why precisely right now I'm not in Gaza, because the border situation is so severe that it's basically closed right now.
Right. So things have obviously become quite difficult again for life there. If the border with Egypt is closed, that means that it's very difficult to get supplies and medical supplies and all kinds of things into Gaza. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, it really is very complicated. In terms of general aid, this goes in via Israel and via Egypt. But really, at the moment, Gaza's suffering from a severe resource, fuel crisis, etc. This is primarily because the really 80% of the goods that were consumed by Gazans, let's say, 3 or 4 months ago, in recent months, that supply line of that 80% has been cut off because the Egyptian security services have destroyed smuggling tunnels under the Egyptian-Gazan border. Why were there these smuggling tunnels? Well, they were there to traverse the border because the actual land border wasn't really open for economic traffic. There was just a trickle of construction materials going in from Egypt into Gaza, donations basically from Qatar and cases like this. So these lifeline smuggling tunnels, obviously illegal in an Egyptian sense because they were smuggling tunnels, really provided an enormous amount of the resources, including fuel, that Gaza needed to run in the way that it was doing, which is obviously not very well because it's an extremely impoverished place.
Yes.
But unemployment has been improving. The situation has been improving. But anyway, this ceasing of the smuggling tunnels to basically practically zero in the terms of the number left of them, and also the closing of the actual border itself, the land border, it's really levied a new pressure on Gaza. It's taken it back years, really, not in terms of economic development, but in terms of freedom of movement and economic freedom. And the key here is that the entity responsible for this is, of course, not Israel.
Yeah. So these tunnels had been in place for years. They were there during the Mubarak period for many, many years, were they not?
They were. And I mean, the tunnels in general are central to Gaza because the armed groups in Gaza use tunnels to move around the Gaza Strip and for kidnapping operations and all these sorts of things. So tunnels are nothing new. And there's a massive tunnel economy in Gaza. People own tunnels, people build tunnels, and et cetera. The tunnels have been in place for a very long time. I mean, it's fairly obvious. You know, if you besiege a people, they will do anyone would do what they can to try and to break out of that.
Absolutely. I mean, on one level, it's totally outrageous that the world, you know, sits back and accepts a situation where you've got a community of people that are totally kind of locked in an open air prison and can only get supplies in by tunneling, and the international community sort of gives the nod to that, and at the same time as Israel, of course, says those tunnels are illegal, and Israel obviously wanted the tunnels shut down for a long time and claimed they were being used by terrorists, whereas in fact they were just an important economic channel. But of course, probably some arms were coming through those tunnels as well. But a situation obviously had been forced on them by this creation, this very isolated community there in Gaza. What is the population of Gaza roughly, Harry?
It's between 1.7 and 1.8 million in a strip of land which is very elongated, of about 42 kilometers in height, with a maximum width of 12 kilometers. So it's a very, very, very small place to have a very large number of people and a very young population, you know, trapped, basically. And right now they are trapped. I mean, the border is closed.
It's a very, very densely populated area then. I mean, for that size, to have that many people. I mean, I'd like to actually get into talking to you a little bit about the situation in Egypt, because that is obviously quite important here. Now, I had looked into this a couple of times, and I've certainly been a bit confused about what's really happened in Egypt, because some people have said that the the regime there, which the Morsi regime, which was overthrown, which was the related to the Muslim Brotherhood, was not in the interests of the people and was doing a lot of things that the people didn't like, and so the people rose up and took down the Morsi regime. There seems to be two views on that as to whether that's been generally a positive or negative thing. But what I'm interested to know is, why did this new regime, which I believe is a provisional military government, why have they now closed the border with Gaza and sealed the tunnels?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's central to the situation in Gaza, so it's very important. There are many reasons, but first we have to understand really one of the factors for why Morsi had so much discontent. There was so much discontent with him, and that's because, or one of the perceived reasons among those who are happy that he was taken down, was that he didn't properly police and secure Egypt's defences and security in the North Sinai, particularly the North Sinai, but generally the Sinai Desert, which is, you know, blobbed on the eastern bit of Egypt, which obviously borders with Israel and Gaza. These areas, in particularly the northern Sinai, have been known historically to be extremely insecure, unstable, prone to what the Egyptian establishment sees as terrorist entities, including Al-Qaeda affiliates. What's happened when the military coup, or whatever you want to call it, came into play, was that they basically escalated their security operations to try and control North Sinai. And this is the reason why, supposedly, that they've closed down the Gaza border to temporarily increase control and security and variables, if you will, in the area until they are satisfied with the security of the area. And it's true that the area hasn't been secure. So it is a rational argument, but obviously it has devastating humanitarian consequences and regional consequences, that is, for the Palestinians. So it's almost like that isn't accounted for in the equation. But that is the operation at the moment, is to try and improve security in the North Sinai. The Egyptian media establishment, you know, blame Hamas, which is the Palestinian faction, which has its own militant associates, if you will, that rules the Gaza Strip. And the Egyptian media establishment blame Hamas, saying that, you know, Hamas militants have been involved in these security issues in the North Sinai of Egypt. So what's happened since Morsi was taken down, was ousted, was that in a way Hamas sees Egypt now, or certainly the de facto powers in Egypt, that they basically feel them now as a hostile entity. So really people are kind of waiting for the Egyptian security to feel more secure in the North Sinai before they will open the border. I mean, it's fairly bizarre, really.
Absolutely.
In terms of the devastating consequences.
And of course, the Palestinian people are just continually the victims in all of this, and it's just, you know, ordinary people trying to live their lives. We are going to break with Truth News Radio Australia, talking to Harry Fear, documentary filmmaker and activist who's done a lot of work in Gaza. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio, and my guest today is Harry Fear, documentary filmmaker who is trying to bring attention to the crisis in Gaza and is helping me at the moment, understand the geopolitical realities in that whole region between Egypt and Israel, where the Palestinian people seem to be just pawns in a game. Harry, you know, would you be able to perhaps fill us in a little more on the background of the way in which the Palestinian people have simply been a kind of a football in this, in these power games between various forces? The establishment of Gaza and these areas goes back several decades now, and there have been several phases of erosion of Palestinian sovereignty and taking over Palestinian lands. Would you be able to just give us a very quick history lesson in what happened in that part of the world over the last 50 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my understanding of the history is my understanding of the history. And, you know, hardline supporters of the Israeli state will have alternative, more softer explanations. But my explanation is one that explains the suffering of the Palestinians, as well as why the situation has become so desperate for them, that there is the armed response that we see among the 1% of Palestinians that take up arms to resist the reality. And I think that, you know, understanding that desperation is very key, because you can't settle any situation without understanding all of the positions and rationalities of all of the actors. So anyway, let me go ahead. But, you know, the point is that after the Second World War, the ideology of Zionism sought to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine, what was known as Palestine. The area was known as Palestine, and it was under a British military mandate at the time. So it was Palestine. Obviously, in 1948, when Israel, quote-unquote, won its independence, and that was a process of basically ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians that were living in Palestine, it won its international recognition as a state. And jumping then forward to 1967 with the Six-Day War, Israel captured additional territories that it weren't acknowledged when it was created, so to speak, in 1948. So then it basically ends up taking more Palestinian land. And since the Six-Day War, Israel has been further settling on internationally recognized Palestinian territory. So, if you imagine it from a Palestinian point of view, the Israel project over the last 65 years is one of expansion and colonization, and that if you see it like that, it's not difficult to imagine the political realities of the Palestinians, particularly in a place as ghettoized as Gaza.
Of course, and the process of sort of acquiring more land has involved increasingly sort of keeping Palestinians divided into pockets. And this seems to make the concept of a two-state solution, which is the one which we always hear about, which appears to be supported by the Western powers, somewhat ludicrous, because how can you have a Palestinian state living happily side by side with Israel when it's kind of divided up into all these regions which have walls and fences and militarized borders? It's quite incredible, isn't it?
Well, it's totally insane. I mean, the whole thing is a total mess. It's not rational. There are two strata fields of language. There is the language of reality, and then there is the language of this old aspiration of a two-state settlement.
Yeah.
And they are far away. I mean, you talked about the settlements. You talked about Israeli citizens on Palestinian land. And when I say Palestinian land, I'm talking about what the United Nations and, as you say, the international community, including Western powers, recognize as Palestinian land, including East Jerusalem. you know, it's hard to imagine how there could possibly be a two-state solution. I think that, you know, when you go there and see it, and I haven't been to the West Bank for 3 years now, but when you do see it, you think, well, you know, how the hell is this going to be solved? Mm. The only thing I would say, though, is that the walls and the Israeli settlers on the Palestinian land, I don't think that they necessarily mean that it's impossible to see them leave. I mean, you had Israeli settlements in Gaza, which were evacuated and demolished, and the Palestinians are living on the land again. So although it would have to take place on a totally incomparable, humongous scale to the east with the West Bank, it's not absolutely impossible that those Israeli settlers could be forced to leave by the Israeli military, which is what happened in Gaza. But I don't think that that is politically realistic, but it's practically realistic.
Yeah.
I think because it's not politically realistic, because there are now so many Israeli settlers on Palestinian land, over 500,000, and Israel is truly expanding into the West Bank. I mean, it's not just settlements. You know, it's like Israel in the West Bank, right? It does seem bizarre to imagine that there could be two states. And Israel or its political incumbent leadership says that the territories of Israel itself are indefensible, and that's why it has to, quote-unquote, occupy the additional Palestinian territories to maintain its security defences, which is, of course, ridiculous because there are other smaller countries in the world which manage to maintain their defences. Anyway, go ahead.
From your experience, is there any real support for this two-state solution anymore, or is it basically just now something that is a piece of rhetoric from diplomatic negotiations of the past that really has no traction with the Palestinian people?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I don't think there's any support for the two-state solution among Palestinians anymore, if that ever was. But I think that there are those that would prefer a two-state solution to a one-state solution. And I'm absolutely sure that they're in the minority. I'm absolutely sure about that. We're talking about a minority. But just to, you know, look at what they say, some of them say, well, at least if we are separate states, we get to maintain our identity and not compromise on our full sovereignty. That's one argument, which says, well, we'd rather have a minority portion of our homeland, which is at least ours, and not sharing.
Yes.
So there are some that see it like that, but you know, that there isn't information available to us about what Palestinians generally want. I mean, what I just said was anecdotal, because we haven't had Palestinian elections since 2006, and there isn't polling done about, well, would you like to live next door to an Israeli in, Haifa or something?
Yeah.
We don't know. But if you analyze the rhetoric, you see very stark images. But I think really analyzing the rhetoric is probably not very worthwhile, because the situation is so desperate in some cases that you just get an untrue image of what Palestinians would be willing to face, live with, and compromise.
Yes, and I imagine because there's been a more or less complete breakdown of diplomatic relations between Hamas and Israel, there really is no clear communication of what the Palestinian people want. And certainly I'm unclear about it.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what people want is freedom, but we don't know what kind of freedom and in what manifestation. And, you know, one of the things which really gets me is to see these divisions on the among the Palestinians, because, of course, divide and rule, and that the consequences of being divided are terrible. And there is such disunity among Palestinian factions, and such stubbornness among some leaders of those factions to give in and compromise and to break the disunity. It's very troubling.
Absolutely. And we want to get into more of that during this interview. I'm talking to Harry Fear, And we will be back after this short break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Really important interview today. Please stay with us. Welcome back, you with Truth News Radio. I'm talking to Harry Fear, filmmaker and activist who's done a lot of work in Israel, a lot of work supporting the Palestinian issues. And we're talking here a little bit about the very complicated and sort of fractured nature of internal politics within the Palestinian territories. And I wanted to ask you, Harry, let's go back a little to the previous era when Arafat was kind of like a unifying figure. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it appeared that the Palestinians were more unified than they are now. And a lot of people have said that Hamas, when it rose up in the wake of the death of Arafat, kind of has become a bit of a caricature of extremism, which is very easy for the Israelis to demonize. What's your take on all of that?
I agree with that. I would say that caricature is in a way true. If I was Palestinian, I wouldn't vote for Hamas. Funnily enough, those that are critics of my work who are supporters of Israel say that I have been supportive of Hamas and etc. Of course, I've never been supportive of Hamas implicitly or explicitly. I disagree with how Hamas has in a way use that caricature image and Israel's reaction to it for its own benefit. I don't think that it's really benefited the Palestinian interests, the general interests of the people. I mean, Hamas posits itself as a resistance movement, but it's also a government. I mean, how do those two things work out? Is one fundamental question.
Indeed.
But also, while those that support Hamas as a resistance movement, while those supporters see resistance as including armed resistance, active quote-unquote aggressions against Israel, that is not just reactions but also proactive operations. And if Hamas doesn't do that, these are all very important questions. The point I'm trying to make here is one example. Israel often says that Hamas is launching all of these terrorist attacks against Israel. If you look at the last year or two, it obviously hasn't been. If you look at it empirically, the organized military actions against Israel from Hamas have been in reaction to Israeli actions. Where there have been other cases of individuals or small numbers of people launching operations, they haven't been part of the military ideology of Hamas at the moment. They have been basically lone wolves or people operating outside of Hamas's remit, the de facto authorities, the government, the regime's remit. So there's this image of Hamas as this kind of aggressor, and many Palestinians that support Hamas wish it was, but it actually isn't. And so that's quite an interesting reality. I hope that makes sense.
It certainly does. And from my memory, what tends to happen is Israel will engage in one of these targeted strikes against some operatives, which it say are bad people, and it reserves the right to be able to just bring in an Apache helicopter and take someone out walking down the street or in a car in a crowded area. And Israel thinks that's an okay thing to do. And they say they try very hard not to hurt civilians, but unfortunately, you know, a few civilians get killed each time. And of course, when that happens, we see some reprisals, like a volley of rockets is launched against Israel. And then, of course, Israel says, well, that's unprovoked aggression. And it's really ludicrous. And it really is just, I mean, the way it is portrayed by the media, again, is not dealing with the real situation. And that's one of the biggest frustrations I find, and I know it's a big focus of your work is deconstructing the media in terms of the way that all this is represented. One of the things I found most puzzling about some of these barrages of rocket attacks that have been launched against Israel is that in many cases, I believe that the recent one, which was last year, the rockets don't actually have any explosives in them. And there were,
that's correct.
I don't understand if this is actually an effort of resistance. Why are they launching rockets, which are essentially toys that can't really do any damage?
Yeah, I mean, the rockets, you know, I've interviewed Hamas spokespersons about the rockets, because as far as I'm concerned, these rockets are not, you know, they're not strategically useful. The point is that, you know, let's just take it back one level. The rocket attacks, be they proactive or reactionary, right? And the rocket attacks are there because the military strategy on the part of the launchers is to balance the terror. So the civilians in Gaza are terrorized by Israel's use of force. So, quote unquote, we will produce a balance where the Israeli civilians are terrorized by our rockets. So the point here is, again, it's not whether actually they are effective weapons, but the point is, do they produce a terror effect? Well, obviously they do, because of the bomb shelters throughout South Israel and et cetera. So let's just look at why these rockets don't have explosives. Well, they don't because there are no explosives available, or not enough for the majority of the stockpiles. There are some which do, and there are improvements incrementally to the military technology. So these rockets, yeah, you said they're like toys. They're like fireworks, you know. They're like fireworks with stones on the end of them. I mean, they're just like, you know, dead weights dropping down.
Yes.
The firers do try, apparently, from the limited information we know, generally to target Israeli military installations, but they're unguided because they are like fireworks, right? So they don't always. And so this is the technicality where they become, from a legal definition, terroristic, because they are not necessarily going to target in any kind of reliable way military installations and figures. So you get Israel's narrative of defending itself against terrorism. And these rockets have injured and killed and do cause destruction. And so that Israeli narrative is alive and real. But in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of the violence of the conflict, of the suffering of the conflict, it's a bizarre thing because, of course, most of the violence and suffering is felt by the Palestinians in Gaza. It is almost an intractable cycle when you look at it in those terms.
It seems like almost a mechanism, really, of empire building and control, doesn't it? The phrase "the great game" has been used, you know, in the past. John Pilger wrote a book about this, about what was going on 10 years ago, and you know, he described it as an extension of the British Empire's great game, which is now kind of being executed by Israel. But there is actually a larger game of empire building, because really Israel is in a sense a proxy for US interests. And what is the United States? Well, you know, there's a conglomerate there of economic forces and powers and multinationals and banks and all kinds of things that really do exert an empire of control around the world. And of course, one of the mechanisms of maintaining that empire is to have a situation where you have enemies that you can then say, well, you know, these people are very dangerous and we have to take action to keep them under control. And of course, that's been the catch cry of the war on terror ever since September 11, 2001, and of course before, but really intensified after then, which of course the Israelis have used as well.
Exactly.
Just a quick take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I to an extent, I think these days Israel is not so much the 51st state of the US or the big military base for the US. I think really it's a kind of ideological base because it's a position towards quote unquote terrorism and control and military dominance and hegemony.
Yeah.
They are the same. The ideologies are the same. But if you look at, for example, the Iran issue right now, or peace with the Palestinians, obviously two central issues for Israel, the United States, or certainly incumbent United States administration and the incumbent Israeli administration, they're not together on that. So I think there are some dissimilarities, and in a sense that's more disturbing because it means Israel is open to less control.
We're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. We are going to break and we'll be back very shortly. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And it is a great pleasure today to be talking to Harry Fear, filmmaker, documentary maker and activist who's elucidating a lot of very important issues about the Israel situation, the Palestinian situation, and the broader geopolitical issues. Harry, please continue there from where you were cut off, because I think you were highlighting some really important points there.
Yeah, sorry, I was rambling on. But no, the point I was trying to make was that these days, I think you can argue that Israel is less manipulable by the US.
Right.
And I think that's obviously a bad thing. If you look at the stances towards Iran or the stances towards making peace with the Palestinians, you know, that there are big gaps in understanding. So I think that in a way this is, you know, points towards a darker reality, which is that Israel has moved away from this kind of, you know, child of the US to really an independent entity which is less open to control.
Indeed. And they, like, they've also claimed, or figures within Israeli politics have claimed, that they can direct US policy as well, haven't they? I mean, it's almost
exactly.
Reverse now. They think they can
exactly.
Pressure the US.
And
of course,
yeah.
you've got these huge lobbies within the government, many, many prominent, you know, people within the US government. And it's always been that way. It doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or Republican government. It always tends to be that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, even if you go back over a decade now, you know, look at what happened with 9/11 and the Prime Minister of Israel saying, you know, this is a good day for Israel because, you know, to infer that now the US understands our terrorism problem. You can see there a kind of level of manipulation and objectifying of the US, which shows really strategic cynicism towards the US. And with these days, the epic amount of control leveled at the US Congress, for example, by pro-Israel lobbies, there is an enormous control. As you say, it is almost the other way around.
Absolutely. I mean, there's not a lot positive at the moment, is there? I mean, is there any light at the end of the tunnel that you can see at the moment in the situation?
Not rationally, but I mean, the thing is here that the situation can't go on forever like this. Some things are going to give. There are going to be, I mean, if you just, I was just thinking on the break there, you know, that there are going to be elections in Israel, right? Things are going to change. I mean, I don't think that's going to cause any great hope or positive change, but things are going to change. And when things are in flux, that opens the door to improvements. It is difficult to see any, you know, strategic rational reasons for things ending with much light anytime soon. But one has to hope, and one has to resist what is wrong and push in the right direction.
Absolutely. And that's why it's very important that people like you continue to do your work, and that more people go to the occupied territories in Israel. And let's talk a little bit about the plan that you have to bring some journalists and filmmakers to Gaza this year.
Yeah, well, this year, in 2013, earlier in July, we took a bunch of internationals to Gaza.
Oh, sorry, that's already gone. I was thinking this year. It's next year. Yeah,
I'm
gone,
also
yes.
Almost living in 2014. Yeah. We're going to do the same in 2014. We haven't confirmed the month yet, but we're going to take probably one dozen internationals from around the world to Gaza for 3 weeks for an intensive kind of elite media production project to try and make the kind of media which can help wake people up to the reality of the suffering in Gaza. We did it this year with two dozen internationals from 17 different countries were involved in the project, and we had success, but not as much as we hope to have on the next one. So if anyone's interested in that and they do have media skills which they can use, and we're particularly targeting people or inviting people to come on this voluntary free project who have media skills and who haven't been to Gaza before,
yes,
then people should sign up for information so they can go to welcometogaza.com.
Excellent. And of course, your site, gazareport.com, and harryfear.co.uk, got a lot of your material on there as well. And I would certainly like to say I would be very keen to join your group, Harry. I don't know if I can, but I'm actually very, very interested in it. And I know the producer of this show, Leah, is very, very keen. And I'm certainly looking into the possibility of maybe taking you up on that offer. But that's to be advised. So there's a lot that needs to be done. Harry, let's talk a little bit about the West Bank, because we've been focusing mainly on Gaza. The settlement building in the West Bank is ongoing, as I understand it, and there have been some recent really disturbing reports. I know we had from Australia. Our new government in Australia seems to have reversed the position of the former government. They said that they're not going to make a big fuss about Israeli settlement building. It seems, and I think Hillary Clinton has kind of given them a bit of a green light too. I mean, can you just tell us what's going on there with that and the international response to it all?
Well, I mean, the international response first, because one can be most impassioned about it. I mean, the Australian response is despicable, as is the British response, as are most of the responses that matter, right?
Yeah.
Because basically there is a soft acquiescence, or there is a soft speaking. There's never any real materially valid condemnation which could cause any kind of political effect on Israel. The powers just don't even bother trying. So what has happened is, over the last few decades, Israel has sustainably increased settlement production. And, you know, people often make a lot of noise in the media, particularly the liberal or left-leaning media, about the settlement expansion continues during the peace talks, as if this is some smoking gun. But it's actually totally obvious, and I like to ridicule it, because of course there is expansion continuing. It has existed from the very beginning, and there's no reason to think that the peace talks would in any way halt it or pause it or stop it. If you look at the graphs which, you know, show the settlement expansion over time, you can see that it's gone on and on and on, and it will foreseeably go on and on and on. So the settlement expansion is one of the key issues, which is a kind of impending hot issue, because the more and more it goes on, the less and less Palestinian land there will be.
Have you had a chance to speak to many Israelis who are supportive of their government, or have you had much feedback from people in Israel, either way, in terms of how they perceive their government? Because I know this is another question where we are largely we have to rely on the media, and the media does not often give us a clear picture. For example, I know that there is a big movement from within Israel, from within Jewish Israeli people, against any kind of military conflict with Iran, but it's on Facebook, and there's a very big Facebook group, and they have videos, and they're doing a lot of work. It never gets a mention in the news. And I think it's really important that we don't get into a situation where we say, well, these are just, you know, bad people. Yep. And, you know, because that's just actually almost falling into the game of being manipulated by these empire builders.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah. And it's really important. And among those that support the Palestinians, I often get really frustrated by a kind of always blame it on Israel approach, and all Israelis must be bad. It's just totally ridiculous, to be honest.
Yes.
You know, if the people that were the supporters of the Palestinians were born in Israel, they would probably be like most Israelis are. You know, Israelis can't be held responsible for where they are born, right? There are in Israel, as you mentioned, those that rise up against the injustices committed by the Israeli state. You know, we've interviewed them quite a bit, or some of them, on our weekly radio show. There are different levels and stages of ideology of resistance against the Israeli state. Some have left Israel and reject the idea of going back. Some stay there and want Israel to remain a Jewish state, but simply want the occupation of the Palestinian territories to cease. So there are different levels of resistance, in a way, different positions. But I just want to say, you know, one thing, which is that, you know, going back to what I was talking about earlier with the Israeli narrative of defending Israel from terrorism and et cetera. You know, as a British citizen speaking to you right now from the UK, the Israeli narrative is not that much different from the British narrative or from the American narrative or from any such narrative. Israel is not that much different to us, because the incredible level of force it's willing to use to destroy those people and infrastructure that pose a security threat to it, the level of force it's willing to use is not different from the US or from Britain that used in Iraq or in Libya or etc. I find it very important to point that out, that Israel is not alone in you know, creating this kind of epic suffering.
So true. Yeah. And certainly in the sort of escalation of hostility with Iran, the US and European powers have played their role to an incredible degree. We only got a few seconds left, but just very quick take. Do you think that the powers that be really want a conflict with Iran, you know, in the event that, as they say, they can't get Iran to stop its nuclear program? Or do you think that is likely, or is that more posturing?
I don't think they want a conflict.
Yeah.
And the assets they can use to have a covert conflict will be largely successful, I suspect.
Absolutely, yes. I tend to agree with you on that. It's certainly a very powerful political tool. And again, you know, having the fear of Iran, it just sort of gives the people in power that increase of grip. But look, we have run out of time, unfortunately. It's been great having you on. I hope to get you on again.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye. That's Truth News Radio for this week. We'll be back next week. See you then, folks.